9 years ago, I preached my worst sermon ever. And it was a night service at my previous church. And it actually happened to be in this very building on this stage right here. What had happened was a week prior, I connected with a renowned worship leader and minister who I really looked up to. And we're getting coffee and we're talking. And then we were talking about how the modern day church, the worship teams have kind of lost their sense of excellence. And we're talking about how modern day preachers don't really know how to teach well. You know, pretty much all the pretentious stuff evangelicals love to talk about. That's what we were talking about. And it ended, our time ended with him saying, "Hey, by the way, I'll see you this Sunday. I want to come visit your church." And from that moment on, I don't know what happened within me, but in me, there was this pressure to perform and to impress him when he came. And so everything that I did from that week, that set list, the sermon that I was working on, underlying beneath, subconsciously, I was trying to impress this worship leader that I really looked up to. And you can guess how it went. Everything went south from there. He came that Sunday. We had an evening service. And our worship team, I'm going to let you in on a little insider secret. You guys know the little earphones that we wear when we play worship? That's not just to hear each other. There's actually a little metronome playing. And sometimes the metronome has a little voice like, verse 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? But there's a metronome playing so that we stay on beat. But when we did that worship set, by the end of the first song, our drummer, our keyboardist, and I all ended on a different beat. And so, you know, it went south so quick. And then came time for the sermon. When I preach, have you ever been in situations where you're talking to someone and all of a sudden you kind of had outer body experience and your mouth is moving, but you come to the realization, I don't know what the hell I'm saying. I'm just rambling on. That's what it was for 15 minutes until the worship team put me out of my misery, started playing the worship song to end the service. It went so horribly wrong, I couldn't even look that worship leader in his eyes when he said goodbye to him. And I got home, and for the first and only time ever after I preached, I cried in my wife's arm like a little baby, and I felt like such a failure. And I was like, why do I feel like this? What's going on within me right now? And I realized now in hindsight what was happening in that moment was that I was coming face to face with what's known as the false self. It's the self that I manufacture for myself to impress others, to perform well, to earn favor and grace in people's eyes. And I realized in that moment what was happening was I was wrestling with the tension of who I actually am and who I'm trying to be to impress the world and present a certain image. Last week, we started a new collection of teachings titled The True and False Self. And this is the premise. Within each of us, not just me, is what the ancients throughout history have called the false self. The false self is the identity that we construct for ourselves in order to be loved, to be accepted, to feel safe, and to feel in control. The false self is who I think I should be and not who I actually am, right? It's the me that social media presents me to be. It's the me that my family expects me to be. It's the me that the work that I do demands me to be. It's even the me that my Christian community idealizes me to be. And so the false self is who I pretend to be in order to survive, but it's not actually me. And that presents a problem because ultimately the false self keeps us disconnected from the abundant life that God has for us. But secondly, it keeps us from real intimacy and connection with other people. Why? Because people are falling in love. They're having relationship with a curated version of me, but not the actual me. And we always worry if they actually saw me for who I am, the questions I have, the things that I struggle and wrestle with, will they love and accept me? The false self stands in that place to protect us from being disconnected from that. And so our goal in this collection really is to identify and unlearn the false self that's in within each of us so that we can step into the true self, which is the truest expression of who God created you and I to be. A life of no more pretending, no more performing, no more proving or earning. The true self is who I am when I trust I'm already loved. So that's what we're going after here, okay? Now, last week, we laid the foundation for this collection. We really just kind of set the placemat. And we took a look at the six stages of faith. It's a framework created by this duo called Janet Hagberg and Robert Gulich. And the stages of faith, it's a framework to help us identify what stage of faith that we're in right now. and how God might be calling us or pushing us toward growth and maturity. And so I'm going to do a very quick recap, and then last Sunday, actually, for the first time ever in my pastoral career, I didn't finish my sermon, and so this is a carryover. Can you believe it? We would have been there for 2 hours, okay? But we're going to do a quick recap of what we talked about last week, the stages of faith, and I want you to think about, what stage might I be in? And if you remember, this is not just a linear path. We revisit stages all the time. It's not that once we finish stage one, we never come back to it. No, we're constantly cycling in and out of these stages. And so stage one is the recognition of God. And stage one, if you remember, we talked about this is the stage where you become aware of God, not just as an idea, but as someone real and tangible. It's often sparked by an undeniable experience with God. Or for some, it takes a long period of small interactions, small ponderings, small moments where you think, can God be real? And it all materializes in this moment where you realize, yes, God is real. It's the time where you recognize that you need something more than just yourself. You recognize your deep need for God. And so stage one is marked by curiosity and wonder. Everything's new. Everything is fresh. If you've ever been in love before, this is the in love stage where you are just enamored. Everything is honeymoon-esque. That's stage one. Stage two is what's known as the life of discipleship. And stage two is when you begin actively following Jesus. You form your beliefs, right? You form your conviction. You learn spiritual practices. And most importantly, you find your people. You find your community. You find your church. And faith is mostly formed in community. They say in stage two, faith is formed by association. And so everything you believe about faith, about yourself, about the world, it's learned within that environment that you place yourself in. Some of you remember seasons like this where you put yourself in a church and you went through the discipleship course and your pastor's theology became your theology. That's what stage two is like. It's marked by learning and growth. And then we come to stage three, which is known as the productive life. In stage three, you're not just learning anymore, you're actually doing. They say the training wheels come off, you're serving, you're building something, you're leading others. Faith becomes productive and it creates real impact. You see the fruit of your labor and you see that it's working for you. And oftentimes the danger in this stage is that your identity begins being wrapped in your effectiveness, in your success, and everything that you can accomplish for God. And so doing trumps being in this season. Then we get to stage four, which is everyone's favorite stage. It's called the inward life or the journey inward. Stage four is a turning point in our faith, often triggered by a crisis or by doubt or by disillusionment. It's the stage where your former beliefs and your certainties are radically challenged. What once worked for you, what once made sense for you, just doesn't anymore. And it's in this stage where we usually encounter what's known as the wall. The wall is the place where you come face to face with the false self that you've created. The version of you that you've built, your identity, your control, your image. When it meets the wall, none of it can pass through and all of it begins to fall apart. Your past traumas, your past fears, your brokenness, they all catch up with you in this stage. You know, there are seasons where we can kind of put off therapy for a bit. But then there comes a boiling point where it's like, I got to actually deal with my mess because it's coming to surface and I can't bottle it in anymore. That's what happens at the wall. And the hard thing is the only way through the wall is not over it, under it, around it. The only way through the wall is literally through the wall by facing it through self-acceptance and surrender, learning to receive God's love, not for who he's calling you to be or who you think he wants you to be, but learning to receive his love and acceptance just based on who you are right now, raw and honestly. And so that is the journey inward. Then if you somehow make it through that, Lord willing, stage five is the journey outward or the outward life. In stage five, you begin re-engaging with life and faith, but now from a different center. You're no longer driven by a need for approval. You no longer feel the need to prove your worth. You begin approaching faith and with humility instead of certainty, compassion instead of judgment, and freedom instead of pressure. And you move outward again into relationships, into calling, into destiny. But now it flows from who you are and not who you're trying to be. Which brings us to stage six, which they say many people never reach this stage. And when I think about my life and my mentors, I can only think of a handful of people that I feel like really embody this final stage, the life of love. In stage six, faith becomes fully integrated into your life. There's no more compartmentalization. You no longer need recognition or success or control. You're no longer striving, no longer afraid, no longer trying to prove anything. Your life becomes less about achieving something for God and more about participating in God's love. Having shed the false self, built on achievement and approval, you now live from your true self, the fullness of who God created you to be. And just as God moves towards you in love, you begin moving towards others in love, loving others not for your sake, but loving people truly for their sake. You guys know that sometimes when you love others, you're really doing it for yourself. I do that all the time with my wife, I have to confess. Sometimes I give her words of affirmation because I know she's going to give me words of affirmation back, right? There are some times where we love selfishly. You know what I'm talking about, right? And if you don't, you're lying, okay? We love selfishly, but there comes a point when we go through the wall and the humility and the brokenness of those seasons where we learn to love others not for our sake anymore, not to receive a specific response or anything in return, but we truly love other people for their sake. And so this, in a nutshell, these are the stages of faith. This is kind of the foundation laid for our collection, this series. And really at the core, if you see it, the thread that's kind of weaving all of this together, the stages of faith show us the journey essentially from the false self to the true self. From the self that we manufacture in order to be loved and accepted and in control and safe to the true self that learns to let go of all of that so that we can live authentically without pressure, without performance, without fear in a life of love. Doesn't that sound beautiful? I could end the sermon right there. That's a lofty goal to achieve. And so we're going to kind of go towards that in this collection. Now, all of this brings us to what I didn't get to last week, which is the life of Peter. And so we're kind of going to do an experiment here today. We're going to take the life of Peter and we're going to connect it with this framework and see how Peter had gone through all the stages of faith. Because sometimes we just need a paradigm. Sometimes we just need someone who's gone through the journey before us to see what it might look like in our lives. And so this journey through the six stages of faith, this journey of shedding the false self and embracing the true self, in my opinion, is most vividly seen in the life of Peter throughout Scripture. And so we're going to track the life of Peter through the six stages of faith. And in seeing his journey, I really think it's going to give us hope and encouragement for our journey. You guys ready for that? All right, we're going to start with stage one in Peter's story and Peter's journey through faith, recognition of God. Now, Simon, or Peter as he's later to be called, he's brought before Jesus by his brother. And Jesus does something really significant here. You know, most people think that Jesus' first interaction with Peter is when he calls him to follow him. You guys know that epic scene where it's like, come follow me and I'll make you fishers of men, right? And he drops his net and he follows Jesus. We think that's Peter's first interaction with Jesus, but that's not actually what happens here. If we look in John chapter 1, Jesus looks at Simon in their first interaction, and this is what he says. He says, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas," which when translated is Peter. There's no call to follow him. There's no call to leave his life of fishing behind. Essentially, Peter's first experience with Jesus is receiving a nickname. Okay, that's his first interaction with Jesus. Now, keep in mind, this sounds, you know, it sounds non-important, but keep in mind, in ancient Hebrew culture, there was so much significance in your name, right? Back then, your name was not just something that you give to your barista at the coffee shop. Your name was your identity and your destiny all wrapped in one. It was a summary of your whole personhood, your whole life, and even the trajectory of your life. So your name mattered. And so Simon, in his first encounter with Jesus, is given a new name, Cephas, or Peter, which means rock. It's a prophetic name declaring who he would become, right? He would become the rock upon which the church is built. He doesn't know that at this time, but Jesus was naming him something new. Jesus doesn't invite Peter to follow him. Jesus doesn't invite Peter into a life of discipleship. He just gives him a new name, a new identity, and a new calling. I love this because sometimes we make it seem that Jesus only meets us and does something for us and impacts us so that he could get something in return from us, right? Our obedience or our money or our time or our gifts or our service. But the beauty of God's love is that it's actually truly unconditional. Why else would he go to the cross for people that would later go on to disown him or betray him? Jesus gives Peter a new name, not to manipulate him into following him, but simply because he loves him. And so this is stage one. Peter begins to recognize Jesus, recognize God, recognize his need for something more than just the life that he's known. And Jesus doesn't require anything in return at this moment. He just gives Peter a new name, a new identity, a new calling. And to prove my point, after this first encounter with Jesus, you would think that Peter, he just begins to follow Jesus around. Peter actually doesn't drop everything and follow him at this time. He actually returns after this moment, this interaction with Jesus, back to his fishing post. And chronologically speaking, the next time Peter shows up is in Matthew chapter 4, which brings us to stage 2, when Peter enters into the life of discipleship. Matthew 4, 18 through 20. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they left their nets and followed him. Catch this. Jesus doesn't call Peter to follow him the first time, but this time he does. And this time, Peter decides to drop his nets, to leave his entire world behind to follow Jesus. Why? What changed? I'll tell you what changed. It's because Jesus gave Peter a new name. That first interaction, he had a significant encounter with Jesus, and now it set the stage for Peter following Jesus, not because he was guilted into it or coerced into it, because he had a beautiful encounter with Jesus that so inspired his life and widened the recognition that he needed God. He needed something more than just himself. Now he was ready to follow Jesus, and so he sits under his teaching. Right? He learns how to pray. He's discipled by him. He goes on to become the leader of the early church, and he follows Jesus faithfully for the rest of his life. Beautiful story, right? But that's not actually how the story goes. There's one problem. In Luke 5, Jesus, he's standing by the Lake of Gennesaret, and the people are crowding around him and listening to him teach. And it says in Luke 5 that Jesus, he sees two boats by the water's edge, and it's left there by the fishermen who are, you know, tending to their fish and to their nets. And he actually gets into one of the boats and he starts teaching. Like one day, I just kind of want a body of water here, just bring a boat and start preaching or teaching from a boat. I have a friend that actually has boat church. It's weird. He lives somewhere in the Midwest, but they just basically meet on the lake and he just preaches from a boat and other people are on their boats. Anyway, that's just a random dream of mine. But that's what Jesus is doing. He's on a boat. And he's teaching to the crowd. But here's the million-dollar question in this scene. Where is Peter in all of this? Because last we heard Peter, he dropped his nets and he made a decision to follow Jesus. But where is Peter? You would think that he would be right there in the front row, soaking it all in, being a good disciple. But that's actually not where he is in this moment. The reality is that after that powerful dropping of the nets moment, Peter leaves Jesus. Did you know that? Early in Peter's story, after he drops his nets and follows Jesus, scholars estimate there's about a 4-month period from that moment where he says, "Yes, I'm going to follow you, Jesus. I'm going to be a fisherman." There's a 4-month period between that moment and this moment where Jesus preaches from the boat. And somewhere along the way, Peter, he decides to leave Jesus and go back to fishing, back to his old life. Back to his old profession, back to his old identity, back to the life he made for himself without Jesus. He was initially intrigued by Jesus. He was fascinated by the man that he was. He had this powerful moment where he committed to him, where he said, "I'm going to drop my nets and I'm going to try following you." But at some point, within 4 months, he drifts back to his old self and back to his old life. He's gone back to fishing. And this is where Jesus comes after him again. If we look at Luke chapter 5, verse 4, when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down the nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." Do you ever wonder why he said that? It's not just because he was so enamored with the glory of God. It's because he knows he left Jesus. Jesus comes back when he went fishing, and he does this miraculous thing for him. "For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken, and so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, 'Don't be afraid.'" And he reiterates again, "From now on, you will fish for people." So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. Listen, we got to pay attention here. Something significant is happening right here. Peter has an initial encounter with Jesus where his name is changed. He receives a new calling, a new identity. But what happens? He goes back to fishing. Then Peter has a second encounter with Jesus where he drops his nets and makes a decision to follow him. But at some point within 4 months, he loses interest. And what does he do? He goes back to fishing. Do you see a pattern here? Again and again, Peter goes back to fishing. Why? Fishing is Peter's sense of identity apart from God. Right? For Peter, fishing is the world that he knows. It's his sense of security, his sense of identity, his sense of provision apart from God. It's a self that he constructed to make himself feel safe, to make him feel in control, to make him feel like he's enough apart from God. Really what fishing is Peter's false self. See, Peter returns to fishing. It's the identity that he built for himself, but it's not the name that was freely given to him by Jesus. And so when Jesus tells Peter, "Cast your net into the deep water," do you know what he's doing? He's speaking Peter's language. He's speaking in a way that Peter would understand. It's his world. You know, one thing I love about God is, you know, God doesn't speak lofty languages that we would not understand. He enters into our world. I met someone who was an engineer, and he said his radical encounter with God was randomly, like, uniquely suited to his profession. And what I love about God is he speaks Peter's language. And it's his way of saying, "You can trust me. You're safe with me. I have everything you need. This is the place. Fishing is the place where you feel most sure of yourself, most in control of your life. But you've been out all night and you haven't caught a single thing, right? This is the life you've constructed, but how is it going for you? You've tried it your way and it still doesn't work. It's not working out. But watch what happens when I enter into your world. Cast the net over the deep waters. The same net that you've been trying again and again, night after night, to catch but have come up empty. Cast your net into the deep water and I can fill your net. I can provide for your every need." Really what he's telling Peter is stop holding on to your need for your control and trust me. You're safe. You're loved. I got you. And what I love about this part of Peter's story is that it's all of our stories. How often on our journey of faith, of following Jesus, do we go back to fishing? Do we go back to the world that we know, where we can be in control, where we feel safe and secure, back to the identity and the life that we manufacture for ourselves, back to the things that we trust bring us security, back to the things that help us feel in control? And how many of us have often felt like Peter in our lives, where the area where we should feel most in control, most safe and secure, is actually terrifying? And it's not working out for us because we're trying in our own strength and we always seem to come up empty. If Peter's story shows us anything, it's that Jesus keeps coming after us and he meets us in the very place we retreat to when we turn away from him. And it's at this moment when Peter recommits himself to following Jesus, where he says, "I'm entering back into the life of discipleship." And some of us, you know, we've kind of gotten off track on our life of faith, but I wouldn't even say it's off track. It's just off the beaten road. And I feel like Jesus, in our stories, he comes after us wherever we go. And so we find Peter entering in from this moment into the productive life, stage 3. Peter becomes a participant in the ministry of Jesus. He's overseeing the prayer ministry after Jesus' sermon. He's feeding the poor. He's helping the sick. He's participating in the miracles, right? He's picking up the baskets of loaves of bread and fish. He's really entering into the life of discipleship, and he's experiencing the most productive stage of his life, where spirituality is all about doing. Where's the next town we got to go to? Who's the next gathering that we have to plan for? Who's the next person that we have to minister to and pray for? And the crazy thing is, it's working. Like, Peter is living his life. He's living his dream. He's tapping into all of his gifts, all of his expertise. He's effective. His ministry is bearing fruit. A lot of people are being impacted. Everything is working according to plan in Peter's mind. He's reached the pinnacle of spiritual maturity. He's doing the thing. And for many of us, that's kind of what we imagine like the pinnacle of spiritual maturity to be like, right? I don't know why we define it this way, but you know, we become a leader in the church, right? And we become people who just know what we're talking about and doing, and we're very productive and impactful. We think that's the top of spiritual maturity. Everything is working out for Peter. But then he enters into what I love to call the crash out era. This is Peter's crash out era, stage 4, which is the journey inward. If we fast forward, after Peter has found so much success in his ministry following Jesus, we find on the final night of Jesus' life, he's explaining to the disciples, Jesus is sitting with his disciples and he's explaining to them what's about to happen. That he's about to be arrested, he's about to be crucified, he's going to die. He even says he's going to come back. I don't think people really believe him. And Peter, he speaks up at this moment saying, even if... I think of this epic moment, everyone's sitting at the table and Jesus is like, everyone's going to leave me. But Peter stands up. He says, even if all fall away on your account, I never will. And Jesus looks at him. And this must have been Peter's most heartbreaking moment. Jesus looks at him and says, truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster, you will disown me 3 times. And Peter in his mind, he's like, hell no. I'll never betray you, Jesus. I'll never leave you. You have no idea what you're talking about, Jesus. I'm not that guy. I'm the guy that stands by your side when everything gets tough. I'm the guy who's going to stick it with you thick and thin. And so you probably know the rest of the story. A moment later, Jesus gets arrested and he's brought before the court. But where is Peter in this moment? Peter, he's standing outside of the court area where Jesus is being summoned. And he's actually warming his hands by a fire of burning coals. When a teenage girl approaches him and asks him, aren't you one of that man's disciples? And Peter, he looks her straight in the face and says, I am not. He's questioned again by someone else a moment later, and he denies Jesus again, I am not. And for a third time, he's questioned, and he denies Jesus a third time, just as the rooster crows. And it's at that moment when it all comes crashing down. Peter, who counted the cost and even said, if everyone walks away, I never will, Jesus. Peter, the life that he's built, being productive in ministry, tapping into his gifts, living his best life, making a real impact. And he experiences this devastating moment of failure that all of us know too well. Right? It's that moment where we realize, I'm not who I want to be. I'm not who I intended to be. I'm not who I'm meant to be. I'm not who I even promised I would be to all my loved ones. And Peter, in this moment of crisis, really what's happening is here is he's confronted with the false self. And he went outside and he wept bitterly. He hit what's known as the wall and he realizes he has nowhere to go. Amen. What if I just ended it there? That would be hella depressing. Now, I want to pause here for a moment before we move on, because we have to talk about the difference between stated spirituality and lived spirituality. What do I mean by that? What's happening here is that Peter is experiencing the gap between the kind of faith that he thinks he has, that he says he has, versus the kind of faith he actually has. We've all been there, right? Like, we say something about the state of our faith, our maturity, our spirituality, but the lived experience of that is radically different. There's a gap. In his mind, Peter really believed it. He really believed if someone would press him and see if he would stay loyal to Jesus, that he would actually stand true and stand faithful and loyal, that he would never betray Jesus. But here, in this moment where it all comes crashing down, we see the gap between his stated convictions, his stated spirituality, and his actual convictions, his lived reality. Now, there are two circumstances that will always expose our lived spirituality from our stated spirituality. Because when we come to church here on Sundays, 9 times out of 10, it's our stated spirituality, right? Every time we sing, that's a stated spirituality. Like, I will trust in you, God. That's a stated spirituality. What's the lived spirituality is, do you actually trust him throughout the week? Do you trust him when you lose your job? Do you trust him when finances are tight? Do you trust him when things are going awry? And so there are only two things that will always, two circumstances that always expose our lived spirituality from our stated spirituality. And they're this: boredom and crisis. The first is boredom. When you can no longer derive your meaning from social busyness, from professional business or productivity of any kind, when you can no longer make that your identity, and there comes a point or a season where you can't do that anymore, where you're just idle and you have nothing to do. Maybe it was the moment you lost your job, or maybe it's the moment you had to take a vacation and you're just itching to do something, to check an email, and you can't stay still, right? When you're just idle and have nothing to do, the question then becomes, where do you go to indulge in your boredom? What do you do to cure your boredom? Do you indulge? Do you open up the fridge? Do you open up the liquor cabinet? Do you go through your text messages and reach out to anyone? You're desperate, anyone to just spend time with you so you don't have to be alone with yourself or your thoughts. Do you try to be productive, inventing tasks or work that you know don't need to get done right now instead of resting? Do you lose yourself in binging entertainment or dating apps? You see, boredom actually reveals a lot about us. Boredom exposes our lived spirituality. It's when we're bored, where we realize this is actually what I believe about myself and about God and about faith, right? I can sing hallelujah and lift my hands all I want at church, but it's not until I'm confronted with boredom on Monday night where my true spirituality is revealed. Boredom, it shows us what we really believe about God, but it also shows us what we really believe about ourselves. What we really believe makes us valuable and loved. Listen, if you've ever gone through periods of unemployment or times where you didn't have to work, have you ever come up with that feeling that I'm not valuable or significant because I can't do something or be productive? That's what boredom reveals. What identity we believe that makes us feel safe, secure, and in control. So there's boredom, and then there's crisis. Profound change always comes through crisis of some sort. The loss of a loved one, the loss of a job, the divorce, the diagnosis. Crisis often comes unexpected and almost always comes unwelcomed into our story. If we had a say, 9 times out of 10, we would say hell no to any sort of crisis, right? Let's be real. We don't want crisis in our lives, but it forces its way into our lives. But it's the only way through which our story becomes a story worth telling. If you've ever watched a movie that stuck with you, I guarantee you the protagonist did not have an easy journey, okay? We wouldn't love The Lord of the Rings if there wasn't 3 movies that Frodo had to go through and Aragorn had to go through to reach the pinnacle of their story. What makes a story worth telling and living is crisis. And it's right here in Peter's crisis where his story finds new and redefined meaning. For 3 years, Peter was living in the reality of his stated belief of the false self. Peter, he thought, I was ready to follow Jesus anywhere. I'm transformed. I'm the rock upon which the church will be built. And even if everyone else turns their back on you, Jesus, I never will. I'll stay loyal and true. That was his stated belief, his stated spirituality. But it was through crisis where Jesus began to shine a light on what had been hidden inside of him all along, the gap between his stated spirituality and his lived belief, the gap between his false self and his true self. And it took a crisis to expose it. But we also see it took boredom to expose it as well, which brings us to stage 5, the journey outward. 3 days later, we find Peter back fishing again, back to his old home, back to his old profession, back to his old life before Jesus. Now, this is significant because fishing represented, if you remember, Peter's sense of identity and security and provision and control apart from God. Fishing is what he knew. Fishing was what he can control. It's the identity that he constructed for himself to feel safe and secure. It was his false self. And you see, after Peter's greatest failure, he returns back to fishing. To the identity he's built, not to the name that he was given. To the place he feels sure of himself, not to the uncertainty of trusting someone else to be his ultimate provision. And to the world where he can control, not the world where he has to trust someone else to provide for him. This is the place where Peter's most sure of himself. And yet, once again, It says right here, after Jesus died and Peter ran away, betrayed him, he goes back to fishing. We find him again. He's been out all night and he hasn't caught a single fish. Does that sound familiar? Right? The beginning of Peter's journey starts with barren fishing. And now after Jesus, he's back to fishing and it's still not working for him. I love this because some of us, we return to that false self again and again, right? And we have to be hit with it again and again. It doesn't work for us. And scripture tells us that early in the morning, Jesus, he stands out on the shore after he resurrects. This is the very place where Jesus had given Peter his name, right? This is back, full circle, back to the beginning, where Jesus said, you are going to be Peter. You're going to be the rock. This is where Jesus is standing now on the shore. The very place where Jesus had told him to drop his nets and follow him. The very place where Peter said yes to a journey and a life, an adventure with Jesus. But it says the disciples didn't recognize that it was Jesus on the shore. John 21:5-6. They see Jesus, but they don't recognize it's him. And they're out on their boats. And it says Jesus called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw out your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. And when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. And it says it was at that moment where Peter recognized Jesus. And he jumps off the boat into the water, and he runs toward him. Now, I want you to pay attention to the scene. And we're going to close here very soon. As Peter approached Jesus, do you know what Jesus was doing? It says right here in Scripture. Jesus was cooking up fish and bread over a fire of burning coals. Now think about this. Do you remember where Peter was when he denied Jesus three times? It says he was warming his hands over a fire of burning coals. What's Jesus doing here? Jesus, he's recreating the scene of Peter's greatest failure. He's recreating the scene of Peter's greatest shame. And he's doing that so he could redeem it, to heal it. It says they ate the bread and fish together, and Jesus looks at Peter and asks him, do you love me more than these? Likely talking about the fish. What he's really saying is, do you love me more than the fish that I just caught you, than the blessing that I just given you? And it's as if he's asking, do you love me more than the identity that you keep running back to? Do you love me more than the self that you've made, that you find safety in? And Peter looks at him and says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. But then Jesus does something curious. He asks again for a second time, do you love me? And Peter, for the second time, he responds, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. And then for a third time, Jesus asks, do you love me? It's kind of like, Jesus, do you have a hearing problem? What's going on? Like, Jesus, do you love me? And Peter says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus, for the third time, says, then feed my sheep. Three denials around a charcoal and three affirmations, three questions around another charcoal fire. In recreating the scene of Peter's heartbreaking moment, Jesus, he's reinstating Peter to his true self. Not as Simon the fisherman, not as Peter the denier, but as Peter, the rock upon which the church would be built, Peter who would feed the early church, the sheep, the name he was giving during their first interaction. He says, feed my sheep, Peter. I've always seen you, and you're still the rock I want to build my church upon. Even in your denial, I've seen you, and you're still the rock upon which I want to build my church upon. I've always seen you, and you're still the one that I want to choose to feed my sheep. At the heart of Peter's story is the journey of shedding the false self to embracing the true self. And we see from this moment on that Peter would truly live into his identity as the rock, in forming the early church, in carrying on Jesus' ministry, in preaching with boldness, in performing miracles. But none of it was done out of the false self. All of it was done from a place of love, and it all culminates at stage 6, the life of love. He had to go through the entire stages, through the journey inward, through the wall, through failure, through shame, to get to the other side, to reach the life of love. And I'll close with this thought. What I love about Peter's story is that his lasting legacy isn't his own competence. It isn't the fact that he was the best or most faithful follower of Jesus. If you actually look at Peter kind of gets, you know, a couple of us, we watch Survivor, and there are certain ways that people, the editors, edit certain characters, right? And so some people get what's known as a bad edit, right? They're always seen like fumbling or like making mistakes. If you look at the Gospels, Peter gets a horrible edit. Peter's literally always failing. He's always saying the wrong things, right? He walked on water, but then he falls in because he doubts. He denies Jesus three times. Peter gets a bad edit. And what Peter is known for, his lasting legacy, is not his competence. It's not his ability to follow God well. His lasting legacy is God's grace. Peter's perhaps known most for his denial, but despite having so many highlights in his life, it's his failure, not his triumph, that he's remembered for. And what I love about that is that sometimes we love to edit out our failures, our mistakes, our low seasons. But if you really think about it, those are the things that reveal God's grace the most. And if this is an invitation into anything, it's to embrace the messiness and the brokenness and the flaws of the story that you and I live into. And so I want to invite us into a time of response. Why don't we close our eyes, and we're going to end with the time of prayer and meditation. I want to ask you a simple question. What is your fishing? What is the thing? What is the identity that you go back to again and again and again? When you come up against your wall, when you come up against your failure, when you come up against your shame, when you come up against no longer being able to bear the burden of the image that you've created for yourself, what is the thing that you return back to? What is your fishing? Is it your work? Is it your relationship? Is it your ability to provide? Is it your ability to be significant? Is it your charismatic personality and your ability to make people laugh? What is the false self, the false identity that you return to again and again? What is your fishing? What is the thing that you believe that will secure you? What is the thing that you find safety in? What is the realm in which you feel like you have total control? I really do believe that Jesus, he's speaking to you right now. Some of you, you've gone back to that place again and again. Some of you are there right now, and you feel like Peter on the boat, and you've been out all night. You've been striving in your own strength. You've been struggling, and you haven't caught a single thing. None of it's worked out. None of it's bared fruit the way that you thought it would. None of it's satisfied the way that you thought it would. And Jesus is meeting you there, in your world, in your identity. And he's saying, cast the net into the deep waters. What he's saying is you don't have to fight anymore. You don't have to strive anymore to make yourself feel safe or in control. You can trust me. You can trust me with your world. You can trust me with your life. You can trust me with your provision. You can trust me with your entire being. Right now, metaphorically speaking, I do believe God is calling us to cast down our nets, to lay it in his hand. Doesn't mean you got to quit your job or not go back to that thing anymore, but it's simply a reframing saying, Jesus, I invite you in. And I trust the journey that you have for me. Right now, I want to speak encouragement to those who feel like they're in the journey inward. They're at the wall. And they're wondering, do I have to abandon this faith thing because it's not working out for me the way that it did in college or a few years ago? When I read scripture, it's not hitting the same. When I listen to the sermons, it's not clicking. And everything that used to work, when I used to lift my hands in worship, when I used to pray, none of it works anymore. And I hear the Lord saying, I'm there with you right now. And you don't have to fight to claw out of it. Just face it with me. Right now, I speak encouragement to those who are there. I speak strength for the journey. Would you be here with us in this time?